You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly look at the AL Central. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for tuning in. In this week's episode, Yordano Ventura gets in a fight and then shows some fight. The White Sox have a busy week on the transaction wire. The Tigers start to get some traction. The Twins try to wake up Byung-Ho Park's bat. And the Indians try to hold on to the division's top spot. We'll also check in on each team's haul from the just-completed amateur draft. Here we go. With Jeffrey Flanagan. Jeffrey, boy, since we last spoke, some things have happened. Yordano Ventura, Yordano Gate, I guess we can call it, in Baltimore, the incident with Manny Machado. Obviously, an eventful week just from that incident alone, with Ventura receiving the 9-game suspension that he is currently appealing. And, you know, after that incident, he comes out against the White Sox over the weekend, strikes out 10 guys. He was, it was a magnificent start, probably a necessary start for him. But, yeah, just kind of process Ventura's wild week for us.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the whole Machado thing seems like it was about a year ago, because so much has happened since then. I mean, this is a team that lost 8 straight games for the first time since 2013, and you know, everything is despair, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Danny Duffy steps up and throws 6 shutout innings and strikes out 10, and Yordano comes back the next day and almost tops him, and, you know, Eddie Volquez follows that up with 7 shutout innings, so all of a sudden, you know, all is right in Royal Land again. They've won 3 straight, and they're within 2 games of first. But back to Ventura, I mean, there were some concerns about him. I've kind of gone through the fight itself and what transpired there, and, you know, there's certainly a lot of blame to go around. Machado has priors himself, so, you know, there's a couple of hot-headed guys who sometimes can't control their emotions, and so next thing you know, there's a fight, and pretty interesting fight too. I don't know who won. I don't know how you scored it, but there was a kind of a glancing blow, and then Yordano tackled him. And anyway, he gets a 9-game suspension, which seems a little high, but you know, that just means he'll miss one start. He is going to appeal. I haven't heard yet whether he's going to drop the appeal, but they go to New York next week, and so he might be heard. The case might be heard there, but he comes back and is just the type of pitcher that, you know, the Royals envisioned him being all along. Looked like the same guy he was in, you know, games 2 and 6 of the 2014 World Series and through the second half of last year. So he's got that ability, and they just need to see it more often.
Yeah, there were reports after the Baltimore incident that the Royals are running out of patience with him and they're trying to trade him. And I know that's since been blown off as I think utter nonsense was the quote I read, but
one of the sources I had just told me it was complete and utter nonsense, and I believed him, because look, it's not like they have this wealth of depth in starting pitching here, you know, and you're going to give up on a guy who's 25 years old, who you have club control over through 2021 at a pretty reasonable price. I mean, it didn't make any sense to me from the beginning, and certainly the sources I talked to just kind of nulled it immediately.
Are the Royals targets in any way? I know Dayton Moore had some comments about how they get pitched inside so much. You know, they don't rate as far as hit by pitches this season. They're kind of middle of the pack.
Right.
Last year they were one of the highest in the American League. But what are your thoughts on that take?
Well, yeah, that's a good point, Anthony. We talked about that a lot last year when they were going through some incidents early in the season, and then of course the big one in Toronto. They were second in the league in being hit by pitches, I think they understand that pitching inside is a part of the game. Now, you don't have to hit guys, but pitching inside, and if you're crowding the plate, you're going to get hit. And to this date, I have yet to see one Royal hitter charge the mound or even have a nasty look, a scornful look toward the pitcher. They tend to just, you know, brush off their jerseys and, you know, trot to first base, take their base, and let's keep playing ball. So I think they're kind of puzzled. And this goes back to the Machado thing. They're kind of puzzled when other teams take such offense to being pitched inside, because that's really what triggered the Ventura-Machado thing was the at-bat previously, where a couple pitches were inside and, you know, brushed him back a little bit, got him off the plate, and he started barking about it when he flied out. And next thing you know, there's a thought. You know, the Royals players I talked to said, you know, we get hit all the time. Dayton said that we get hit all the time. I don't think it's being targeted. I think it's just, you know, they got a lot of guys who kind of get close to the plate, and if they get knocked back, hey, that's baseball. As long as you're not, you know, throwing for somebody's head and trying to injure them, you know, that's part of the game. You have to command both sides of the plate, and the inside part of the plate is very key.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, a great start for Ventura. There's no getting around the fact that once the suspension is, you know, the actual number is settled, I mean, he's going to miss one start.
Right.
But obviously that was a very encouraging one against the White Sox. And they had two encouraging starts since then. I want to talk about Danny Duffy, who also struck out 10 White Sox over the weekend. And, Jeffrey, unlike in years past, those strikeouts aren't coming with a ton of walks. I know you've noted he's gone exclusively to pitching out of the stretch, and it seems like that specific delivery and just the mechanics in general, something's clicked here for him.
It really has, and we kind of saw, you know, when he started in the bullpen this year, and he was very dominating, and he took that to, and as they continued to stretch him out to be a starter, filling in for, I think, Chris Young at the time, and we just consistently see him be consistent. I mean, he's cut down on a lot of the moving parts in his motion, and he told me something the other interesting after the game against the White Sox, that he feels so good about his command right now that he can actually purposely miss with pitches, which is something that, you know, Danny used to miss all the time, just, you know, by accident, you know, and now he's actually trying to get hitters to chase bad stuff because he knows that he can still throw a strike on the corner whenever he wants. And he had a pretty long streak. I think it was over 17 innings of 88 batters without walking a guy, which is the longest streak of his career. And it's just a new guy. He's another guy. He's 27 years old that they've been waiting on for years, as you know. And suddenly he's emerged as their best, most consistent starter. And boy, that's just what they need. They need a power arm like that. If Ventura can, you know, continue to do what he did last time out, and you know, Eddie Volquez seems to be right at his ship. They're back to having the type of starting pitching they envisioned when the season started, and the type of starting pitching that's got them to the World Series the last 2 years.
We are joined by Scott Merkin, and Merk, man, we got a lot to unpack since we last spoke. Not the least of which is the White Sox storm back to beat the Tigers. Overcame a 7-run deficit to win in 12 innings on Monday, so that was good for the soul, as it were. It was also a bad night for James Shields, who put them in that early bind. I wanted to dig in on Shields here a little bit. 23 earned runs over his last three starts, one of which was, of course, with San Diego. And I think it was Jason Stark pointed this out on Twitter for the sake of comparison. Jake Arrieta, who pitches, as you know, for that other Chicago team, he's given up 22 earned runs in his last 25 starts. So two different worlds right there. But what is up with Shields, and also what positives do you take from Monday night? Because obviously the last three innings were better than the first two.
Yeah, it's been crazy because, you know, the 10 starts he had before these last three, he had an ERA at 3.09. You know, and I realize he's pitching in a good pitcher's ballpark out in Petco, but whatever park you're in, it just seems weird, barring some sort of injury and he's, you know, he's healthy, that you would just kind of lose it in three starts. And I'm not talking about lose it like, you know, six innings, five runs or something like that. Like, lose it like, you know, get teed up like batting practice for basically two starts and then two innings of your first start, your third start, I'm sorry. So, yeah, I would think it's mechanics issues, you know, that he's doing something wrong. Pedro Martinez actually tweeted out to him about some mechanics issues during his last start against Detroit. And to Shields' credit, he did, you know, finish strong. He gave up one earned run in the third, which was his doing. He threw a ball away on a grounder back to the mound that should have been a double play, and then he pitched two scoreless innings to finish. The biggest thing I see with him is just the strikeout-to-walk ratio is terrible right now. And for a guy who's, you know, does give up home runs, but usually is a strike thrower, he seems to be all over the zone. So, again, that signals to me kind of mechanics issues, you know, with the understanding that he is healthy. So, you know, he'll keep working and try and get back in it. They're certainly not giving up on him after two starts, not even close. And, you know, the one thing about the series against Detroit is they seem to have pretty good matchups. You know, they missed Justin Verlander, they missed Michael Fulmer, who is, you know, maybe as good a pitcher as there is in the American League during the last, 30 innings he's thrown. So, you know, nothing against who they're facing in the series, but they felt like they had a chance even down 7-0 in that game. Nonetheless, you know, it's a bullpen killer when you're scrimping just to get a starter to five innings, so he's got to be better.
Yeah, and when they
acquired Shields, we talked about it last week. The question was Matt Latos or Miguel Gonzalez staying in the rotation, and they stuck with Latos for one more start, and then he gets designated, and man, it just makes your head spin how fast that all unraveled. 0.74 ERA in his first four starts, and a 7.25 ERA over his last seven, and you know, there's always underlying numbers that can be cause for concern, even when you are going as good as Latos was in those first four starts. But I don't think it was anything to suggest it would be this bad and that he'd be off the team by early June.
No, once again, I felt kind of ridiculous at the beginning because, you know, we saw him in spring training, that the rest of the writers met TV people or whatever. And I thought, well, you know, this isn't going to last very long. I mean, he doesn't look like he can't get anyone out. He's not throwing very hard, and, you know, he's not locating. And then he comes out and looks like, you know, Cy Young through, what, two earned runs in his first 24 and two-thirds innings, plus not many hits. I don't remember. I think it was like six hits in his first 18 innings. And you're thinking, man, you know, this is really a veteran guy who knows what he's got to do and turns it on when he has to. And to his credit, you know, he wasn't awful. He wasn't good from that point on, but, you know, it just was a consistency thing. And again, the bullpen, you know, you have to understand that they went hard in April because they had to have, not that they've, you know, toned it back since, but this is a team that had to have a good start. They could not be digging out of a deficit once again. So I think, you know, they used the bullpen maybe a little more in April than you usually see. And when you start having starters consistently not going deep into games, then it really starts affecting. And you saw that. You saw that in, you know, the seven runs scored by Texas in the eighth inning in to erase an 11-6 lead, and then the seven runs in the ninth inning against Kansas City, which is still more of a shocking anomaly than anything else. But the bullpen is a little overworked. And the thing with Latos is, I think it was pretty much known that he was going to be a starter or he wasn't going to be on the team. He wasn't going to be a relief pitcher. You know, Gonzalez, they felt like, could handle that role. I don't believe they felt Latos would be a good guy coming out of the pen, you know, maybe working once every 6 days or working two out of 3 days in long relief. It just wasn't going to work. So they made the move, and Gonzalez has been great out of the rotation. And, you know, Latos, they don't get to that 17-8 start in April without Latos. So, you know, credit to him on that, but the move had to be made.
I got to tell you, Mark, I got these little notes to self here for these podcasts. I've had this one sitting here for 2 or 3 weeks now. We kept getting distracted by other topics. But the note said, at what
it's not about the Eagles,
up,
is it?
It's not about the Eagles. We get to the Eagles every week somehow, but we didn't get to this one. It said, at what point do they give up on Jimmy Rollins and bring up Tim Anderson? And that moment arrived before I could even bring it up on this podcast. It arrived last Friday. Take us through that decision.
Yeah, it was quite a busy time during the draft for the White Sox. They made quite a few few changes and additions during that time. I mean, Jimmy Rollins is not hitting the ball left-handed, but he was a good guy in the clubhouse. He was a solid influence overall and wasn't, you know, terrible, just wasn't making huge contributions offensively and probably had lost a little bit range-wise, shortstop-wise. But the biggest thing was Tim Anderson forced the issue. You know, Tim Anderson is there. You know, I guess you can flip a coin. I think MLB Pipeline has Carson Fulmer as the number one prospect, and Anderson was second. Either way, he's their best position player in the organization, and he forced the issue. He forced the hand, and they had to make a move, and Rollins, you know, handled as a pro as everyone expected he would. And as a matter of fact, he texted Anderson afterwards, congratulated him. Anderson said, you know, the first game of the Detroit series that Rollins has continued to talk to him and all that. So, you know, he was kind of a mentor to him in a short time when he came in spring training and during the season. And it was, you know, not quite as much about what Jimmy Rollins wasn't doing as much as it was time for Tim Anderson to come up here and play every day. And you have to understand, Tim Anderson is the everyday shortstop. You have a very good utility guy in Tyler Saladino to step in wherever and whenever needed. But, you know, Anderson, they basically told him, hey, it's your job, 156 or 456, whatever you're hitting, just enjoy it. You're not the savior of this team. Just go out and play what you've been playing in AAA Charlotte. And that was more the case, that it was just his time to play at the big league level.
And Anderson getting some time in the leadoff spot now, so that'll be interesting to watch. I'm sure we'll talk about
that. And that makes sense. I kind of thought last year, I did a story about this last year. I talked to Adam Eden about it, that, you know, with him hitting for more power last year, he hasn't done that as much this year. And I think he drove in like 54 runs last year, which is a career high. I thought he would be a pretty solid number two guy. He handles the bat pretty well, take advantage of the guys on first base with that hole in between first and second there. And, you know, he first game, of course, is a very, very, very small sample size. But he had four hits, five times on base, scored a couple runs, drove in a couple, including the game winner. So I think you're going to see that Anderson-Eaton 1-2 punch at the top continue for quite a while longer.
Jordan Bastian joins me here. Maybe Tribe Talk should be the name of it, although that's kind of not very original. But, JB, you're in Kansas City. You're about to pick up some Oklahoma Joes, which is actually, that's not the name of Oklahoma Joes either. It's Joes Kansas City, correct?
Yeah, but, you know, I'm old school, so I give a shout-out to Oklahoma Joes, Joes Kansas City now.
Quick ranking of Kansas City barbecue places, top three, go.
Oklahoma Joes, Joes Kansas City is my number one nationally. I make sure I always go there when I'm here. It's the part ambience. You're in a gas station. You have to wait in line out the door. And then I buy up some of the barbecue sauce, bring it home, and have some good summer grilling with it when I'm back in Ohio. Everyone else is second. Q39 is really good. That one's climbed the charts. And then I think everyone else is tied for third. I got to give a special shout-out to Slow's Barbecue in Detroit, though. That's high on the list as well.
That is very high on the list. I got to go Char Bar, number one. If you haven't tried that, give that a shot. And then probably Q39. And then it's a tie for me. Oklahoma Joe's, Jack Stack, what have you. So we solved that major life issue.
Yeah, I guess we can't be friends anymore because Joe's is number one and it's not even close.
Yeah, I just, you know, there's something about walking out of a place with the, you know, reeking of barbecue sauce and gasoline that, I don't know if that adds or takes away from the ranking.
That's what's so great about it.
All right, so the Indians. The Indians are in first place.
Right.
Two-game lead as we record this going into Tuesday. Lost to the Royals on Monday night. You know, one takeaway, JB, is they've been playing better ball on the road here lately. Of course, I mentioned the loss Monday night, but they still won 7 of their last 11 games away from Cleveland. They had lost 12 of 23 on the road prior to that. So, you know, going on the road, and always the West Coast trips are always difficult, but to kind of maintain their place in the division has been encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, as far back as baseball goes, I think the kind of the general philosophy for a good team is to take care of business at home, you know, have your home field advantage, and then you hope to play around 500 and in a great scenario a little bit better. And on these West Coast swings especially, this takes a lot out of teams that have to go to the West Coast and who can lose in their last at-bat. So yeah. I think the fact that you're looking at a road trip here where they could come away with a winning record or right around 500, I mean, that's a win in the with the way baseball works. So I think it's been a really encouraging road trip so far. And yeah, they lost the first one in Kansas City, but it was a 2-1 game, and it's kind of a lot of little things that kind of bit them. But I think you'd rather lose those close ones and know that you played pretty well than get blown out or something. And obviously they took care of Kansas City quite well when they were back in Cleveland last time.
Yeah, there was not a lot going on offensively for either team on Monday night, but one conversation that kind of came out of that was the continued struggles of Yan Gomes. Now has a .169 average for the season, .208 on base percentage, .349 slugging percentage. Jeez. Over his last 12 games, he's 4-37.
Yeah.
We talked about it a couple times. There's been a couple times this season where, you know, he does get a clutch hit of some sort, and you think, okay, maybe that's what's going to spring him, but it just hasn't happened.
Yeah, and I think the clutch hits, or the RBIs, I mean, that's one thing that Terry Francona keeps pointing to. And I think it's because he doesn't want Yan to keep hearing how bad he's hitting. He wants to try and emphasize the positive, which is he almost has as many RBIs as hits, which is good. The problem is there's not that many hits. So it's been pretty discouraging. He had that one hot stretch where he homered in 3 straight games, and you kind of thought maybe he was turning a corner. And, you know, I mean, really the Indians are kind of in a tough spot here where all they can really do is wait for him to get out of this funk because Roberto Perez is still shelved for at least another month or two, and Chris Jimenez, while he's been playing admirably and handling the pitching staff well, which is what you want from your backup, and he's also hitting under 200 as well. And he's been playing almost half as much lately. So you can tell Francona has, you know, yeah, Yan missed a couple games with injury on the road trip, but you can tell he's trying to mix in Jimenez more. He's kind of Trevor Bauer's personal catcher and, you know, trying to pick spots here and there to not only give Yan Gomes a rest or a mental break here and there, but try and balance getting him hot as well. And there were a few situations on Monday in Kansas City where he came up with runners on late and both times grounded into a double play. And we've seen him some at-bats go up with batting gloves on, and other at-bats he doesn't have batting gloves, or he's been wearing glasses lately, and then last night in his last at-bat he went up without his glasses on. So I wonder how much he's in his own head, too, with this, and I think that's kind of a big part of the battle for Yan right now, is just to try not to get, you know, as the old cliche goes, try not to get two or three hits in one at-bat. He's going to kind of chip away at this and realize that batting average is going to look ugly for a while, but you know, he won a Silver Slugger 2 years ago, so it's in there.
It's pretty crazy. He's got 29 hits, 27 RBIs, so yeah, that's at least when he has had the hits, they've come in good spots. But
right,
geez, it's just an odd season line for Mr. Gomes. You know, during this trip, there was a report out there about Michael Brantley and concern from the club that he'll be out for a significant period of time. And you know, JB, I'd say that concern was fairly obvious when they put him back on the DL. I believe our good friend Paul Hoynes, who I think is going to Oklahoma Joe's with you, if I'm not mistaken, he called it sensationalizing the obvious, which I thought was a good description. But
yeah.
It just seems like kind of a status quo situation. This is a delicate situation. It's going to be probably a long-lasting situation because it's such a slow progression when you're waiting for that shoulder to respond.
Right. I think it was a case where something we've known locally kind of got national attention because one national columnist got some information and put it out there, and it was really vague. It was like, we'll miss a significant amount of time. Well, what's your definition of a significant amount of time? I would wager that he's already missed a significant amount of time, and if it's another week or two bad of that value, that's significant. So it's not like the news was he's done for the year. You know, we talked to Terry Francona yesterday, and he said Brantley continues to progress through the soft toss stage of his hitting program. You know, all the reports have been as expected so far from the medical staff, and Tito said he's looking forward to getting back to Cleveland to the homestand to kind of get a, you know, face-to-face meeting with Brantley to see where things stand and see if he's close to advancing the batting practice on the field, which he might be when they head home. So, yeah, I think when he went on the DL the second time, I think just for those of us who've been around this situation since day one of spring training, but even dating back to the offseason, you know, we've known it was going to be a while. And, you know, you felt like it was almost a miraculous recovery when he came back as quickly as he did. And maybe in hindsight, maybe they did bring him back too soon. But as we've discussed ad nauseum on this podcast, how would anyone have known? You know, if Brantley's saying, I feel great, I'm bouncing back great, I'm ready, and that's the focal point of your offense and a guy that you trust, that a leader in that clubhouse and on the field, you're going to trust him. You know, you're going to put him in the lineup, you're going to activate him, and unfortunately it turned out he wasn't ready. You know, so now they want to make sure they're not starting and stopping, that they bring him back when he can play for the duration of the season. And so maybe we're looking at a second half, or you know, maybe after the All-Star break or closer to August. Who knows?
We are joined by Rhett Bollinger. And Rhett, the Twins, obviously a lot of their offense this season is going to be tied to Byung-ho Park, the guy they signed from Korea, got off to a really strong start with his initial acclimation to the big leagues. But lately, things not going particularly well. The Twins roughed up Jared Weaver on Monday night, as teams tend to do this season, but Park was 0-for-4 in that effort. In his last 22 games, he's batting 139 with a 253 slugging percentage, 30 strikeouts against 8 walks in that span. And there's been talk of a bulky right wrist. I'm not sure how much of these struggles are related to that injury, but seems to really hit a wall here these last few weeks. What do you make of it?
Yeah, he definitely really has. He has had a real slump here the last couple of weeks. A lot of strikeouts is kind of the big thing there. He was kind of, you know, given a day off on Sunday to kind of clear his head. I think he struck out in 8 of his previous 11 at-bats before that. So he got Sunday off and then returned Monday, and as you said, he went 0-for-4, so couldn't get it going after that. Yeah, I mean, the risk could be a little bit of a factor. Obviously, we have not seen the same kind of power numbers we saw. He started to kind of get into a groove there early in the season, you know, leading the team in home runs. He still does. He's still tied for the team lead with 11 home runs with Miguel Sano. But it's just kind of dried up here recently. It was kind of funny. Mulder said that, you know, he talked to Park and asked him, you know, what did you do when you got in these kind of slumps in Korea to kind of get out of it? And Park just kind of laughed and said, I'd never gotten these kind of slumps. He just didn't have to. He dominated over there in Korea. So it's kind of funny. But, yeah, I'm curious. I'm actually going to Korea next week. I have a friend that lives there, and I'm going to visit him and also kind of do some stories about Park and Korean baseball. So I'm curious to kind of hear what, you know, his former teammates and what his former manager and all the fans there think of what he's been doing this year. Because it was a hot start, but so far he's starting to really struggle here.
Well, that'll be an interesting trip, Brett. Did Park give you any tips for that trip?
He did a little bit. Yeah, he did. Actually, he got so excited when I told him that I was going that he started speaking to me in English. Because his English is definitely getting a lot better. But usually, you know, when he talks to the media, he talks with his interpreter, J.D. Kim. But the nice thing is, too, is his interpreter, J.D., worked for the previous team that he played for and all that, too. So he had some contacts to kind of give me to kind of have everything set up so that when I go there, I have credentials and everything else. But, yeah, he gave me some tips on what to do and what to see and what to eat and all that. And I look forward to talking to him, too, about it more this weekend before I leave.
Very cool. We look forward to catching up with you about that on a future podcast. For now, elsewhere in the field, Eduardo Nunez over at shortstop. He's hitting .324, .354 on base percentage, .507 slugging percentage, 9 homers, 24 RBIs, 15 stolen bases, and 33 runs in 56 games. Pretty strong numbers, I'd even say, borderline on the all-star conversation when you kind of compare them to some other offensive numbers at that spot in the American League. You know, he started the majority of the games at short this season. He's supplanted Eduardo Escobar as the starting shortstop in the short term. I've seen some comments recently from Paul Molitor about kind of long-term, not ready to anoint him as an everyday player. And you know, that opinion, like every opinion in baseball, is kind of subject to change, but he is 29 years old, so I just kind of curious, what are your thoughts on Nunez's season and maybe even his future there?
It's been really impressive. You know, last year in limited playing time, he had, you know, a pretty decent offensive season, nice, you know, bat off the bench, but nothing more. And sure enough, this year, due to injuries to guys like Plouffe and Escobar, he got regular playing time and, you know, got really hot to start the year, and it's kept it going. That's the most amazing thing. You kind of thought, okay, at some point, he's going to come back down to earth. It's, you know, it's Nunez. Like I said, a decent hitter throughout his career, but has been a utility player for 7 years with the Yankees and Twins. So it wasn't like he's ever really had a chance to be an everyday guy, but at the same time, he never really showed a reason why. And his defense has kind of been more of the issue throughout his career than his offense. But to have this kind of a breakout season at this age is definitely very surprising. And the Twins are definitely trying to promote him as an all-star. They've got the Vote Nunez campaign, even though he's not even on the ballot, because coming into the year, coming in as a backup player, you know, obviously not on the ballot, but it's been impressive. Some of it, you know, is driven by a little bit of luck. He has a high batting average on balls in play. Will probably come down a little bit. But, you know, the power and the speed numbers are there. I mean, he's hitting some home runs and stealing a lot of bases. I think he has more stolen bases now than anybody did on the Twins last season. I think Hicks led the Twins with 13 stolen bases last year, and I believe Nunez is at about 14 or 15 already now. So the speed is legit, and so the Twins want to ride it out and see how long it lasts. And like you said, with Molitor, just because of his track record, Molitor wasn't sure, you know, kind of saying that he wasn't, you know, sure that he's going to be a regular for the rest of his career or even for a long stretch, just because it is kind of, you know, a breakout that kind of came out of nowhere. But if he keeps hitting and playing like he can, obviously he has the potential to be an everyday guy. I think this year they're going to keep riding him out and making him their everyday guy until he proves otherwise, because so far he hasn't really gotten any type of slump at all. He's been kind of keeping it going all season.
We're recording this on Tuesday, and Glenn Perkins is scheduled to receive a second opinion on his left shoulder today in California. But generally, Rhett, when there's a second opinion, that means the first opinion wasn't too optimistic. I know Perkins himself doesn't seem wildly optimistic about what's going on there with his shoulder. Has not pitched in the big league since April 10th, and has not really been able to get it up to a 100% effort level because of the shoulder since then. So just seems like a difficult situation there for the closer.
Yeah, it has been. He's, you know, he threw three bullpens. He's supposed to throw one originally, you know, a couple weeks ago, and got that pushback because of, you know, some lingering soreness. Fought after a little bit of rest, but he felt good enough to start throwing again. Threw that first bullpen and did okay in it. Didn't throw at max effort, but said everything kind of went fine. I talked to you after the second one, and I kind of realized, you know, he wasn't exactly saying it went as well as the first one. I could tell something was maybe a little bit up. It didn't go great. But then after the third one, he had to shut it down completely because it just wasn't feeling right. And so he's going back for that second opinion. Hopeful that he won't need surgery, but you never know. It's been one of these type of years where he just has been hurt all year. He came into, you know, spring healthy and in better shape than last year and kind of wanted to you know, obviously proved himself after the second half of last year, where he really was hurt throughout most of the second half and you know, couldn't really contribute to the Twins trying to make the playoffs late in the season after being an all-star in the first half. So it's been a rough year for him. Definitely very curious to see how it all goes with this second opinion and kind of what they find with this. He had an MRI on Monday. But yeah, definitely a frustrating thing for Perkins. And I think a lot of fans are frustrating seeing another closer out for this long too. And yeah, it's just been a kind of an all-around frustrating season for the Twins and for Perkins.
Since we last spoke in the pen, they claim Neil Ramirez off waivers. This is his third team in the last month. The Cubs and Brewers have both released him in recent weeks. And JT Chargois came up. In general, it just seems like they needed some fresh arms back there because I think you noted this is, I believe they have the second most innings in the American League from that relief corps.
Yeah, and even I think pitching-wise, I think they've used like 22 pitchers already this season,
yeah,
which is pretty amazing considering we're not even to the All-Star break yet. But yeah, JT Chargois is a big relief prospect for them. Great numbers at AA and AAA this year, a ton of strikeouts. Needs to work on his command a little bit, but he does hit in the 97, 98 mile per hour range. Made his debut, didn't go well, giving up five runs to the Red Sox. Got beat up pretty good in it and got sent down. But I'm sure he'll be back up pretty soon here, kind of just work on the command because the stuff is definitely plenty good. They definitely project him to be a very good bullpen piece for them going forward. Ramirez is a guy that had a great rookie year 2 years ago with the Cubs, very impressive year. And then last year dealt with a lot of injuries, some shoulder injuries, abdominal injuries. Limit him to only, I think, 19 appearances in the majors. This year, the velocity is still down. I don't know if he's still coming off the injuries or what, but made his debut with the Twins on Monday. Also didn't go very well as well. I got to wonder if his average fastball velocity when he was with the Cubs 2 years ago was right around 95. He was a hard thrower, and last night he was mostly sitting 91, 92. So I think once he gets that velocity back, he could be that same guy, but it might be gone. You never know. So I think the Twins just trying to take a flyer here on a guy that had a very good year a couple years ago and see what he has. And worst case, they could obviously just send him down if it doesn't work out again. But, yeah, it's one of those things where they're going to try some guys. I'm sure we'll see some other guys in the bullpen going forward just because this team definitely needs arms with the way things have been going on the pitching side.
We are joined by Jason Beck. And, Beck, I hesitate to say this. We're recording this on Tuesday. I hesitate to say this a day after they just blew a 7-run lead. But the Tigers are 17-10 dating back to mid to late May. So, I don't know, are we starting to get some semblance of traction here? It's obviously been an erratic season to this point.
We'll see. They have an interesting stretch of schedule coming up here. Obviously, they're in Chicago where they blew the 7-run lead, and then they go on there to KC for what's going to be a pretty crucial 4-game set for them against the Royals. And that could really kind of put a little bit of definition into the AL Central race heading into midseason and kind of heading into the evaluation portion where teams start to decide whether they're buyers or sellers. I think they have a stretch coming up too where the Indians come to Detroit and then they go to Cleveland right around the 4th of July, I believe.
That is correct. I don't know if Michael Fulmer's scoreless inning streak will last until the 4th of July, but geez, it's pretty much on a roll right now. 28 1/3 straight innings. Fulmer has now made 4 consecutive scoreless starts of at least 6 innings with 3 or fewer hits allowed, joining Jake Arrieta as the only pitchers to do that since the mound was moved to 60 feet 6 inches back in 1893. So this is pretty amazing stuff back from Mr. Fulmer. We talked about it, it seems like, every week here lately, and the application of that changeup and how that's become such a weapon for him. But this is historic stuff we're seeing now.
Yeah, it should be interesting to see how it goes going forward. He'll get a nice test in Kansas City. I know it's not quite the same Royals offense that would kind of run up pitch counts on young hurlers, but there's still enough talent there where I think they could provide a pretty good test for him and his ability to pound the strike zone without giving up too much solid contact. And that's the thing with him right now is that, especially the way things came together on Sunday in New York, he doesn't have to necessarily be throwing up to top velocity to get out. And that's a pretty big learning curve for a guy to make at that early stage of his career.
Fulmer's going so good, it almost overshadows, from a national perspective, at least much talk about Justin Verlander and just how good he's been this last month plus. His last seven starts, he's got a 1.93 ERA. He's got a 168 average against. He's got a 480 OPS against, 57 strikeouts against 11 walks in 51 and one-third innings. I mean, this is, you know, he doesn't have the vintage Verlander stuff necessarily, but he certainly seems to have figured out how to get vintage Verlander-type numbers.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, this is kind of the Verlander 2.0 I think a lot of people were talking about. I know we've mentioned that in the past, including on the stretch last year, but it seems like, especially with that slider-cutter combination, even though it's still kind of a sign of a – it's the same pitch. It's an inconsistent slider that acts like a cutter when he elevates it. But it seems to be throwing some hitters off, and at the very least, it changes the eye level on some guys. I think the more effective pitch right now is a tighter curveball. I know we've mentioned that on numerous occasions. You know, the better he throws it, the tighter it is, and the better he locates it, the tougher it is on hitters.
You know, Ian Kinsler is another guy who I think gets somewhat overlooked from a national perspective. In the month of June, he's hitting 327 with a 571 slug, 16 RBIs in 12 games, 6 extra base hits, homers in 3 straight games as we record this. But, you know, I just think that probably one of the more underrated players in baseball, really, because we're talking about a guy who's actually compiling an interesting Hall of Fame case at this point in his career. Not getting much traction on the All-Star ballot, as we saw with the release of the latest results here today, you know, lagging far behind Jose Altuve. But it's just a special player having another special season. But
well, if you go to buy the All-Star results, he's no Omar Infante either, I guess. But but no, it's I think he just seems to defy age right now. He's at that stage of his career, or he's just entering that stage where a lot of second basemen would be on the decline, and at the very least, he'd be looking at potential new positions for him. But he still handles the spot very well defensively. I think that the advanced metrics bear it out. He's really one of those few Tigers at this point that consistently gets favorable ratings on the defensive metrics. And part of it's because he knows how to position himself. Part of it's because he knows the hitter so well after all these years. And then hitting wise, I think he's really kind of, you know, the prototypical leadoff hitter for this lineup. He can be aggressive. He runs the bases well. He doesn't have to steal a ton of bases given the guys behind him, but he knows how to put himself in a position to get a lot of runs out of hits. And I think when you look at what makes this Tigers offense go, I think too often this guy gets overlooked.
I agree. Victor Martinez, it's hard to overlook what's going on. Anytime there's anything related to the knee with Vic, you feel a little uneasy. He's got right knee soreness right now. Thankfully, MRI revealed no structural damage. So this one doesn't appear overly serious, but the Tigers are taking extra caution.
Yeah. And it's, you know, given how big of a role the knees played in his decline at the plate last year, I think it's something you have to, at least on the surface, be wary about and kind of watch how it goes along. He's still playing a very tough at-bats, and he still seems to be hitting for some pretty good punch there, especially for somebody's age. But it's something where I think you have to be at least a little bit concerned about it over the long term. And it might be something that warrants giving him a day out of the lineup here and there once he does come back. Maybe it gives an excuse to put Miguel Cabrera at DH and maybe get somebody else in at first base, whether it's Andrew Romine or Marcus Davis or somebody else.